Hello and welcome to the Defense Cafe, the Liberal Security and Defense podcast brought to you by the Friedrich Naumann Foundation for Freedom in Brussels. I am Sebastian Vagt from the Friedrich Naumann Foundation. I'm your host.
And I'm Theresa Reiter. I'm a liberal defense enthusiast from Austria.
And today we will be meeting András Radnóti from Budapest. András is a founding member of liberal opposition party Momentum and managing director at risk intelligence firm Millennium Emerging Europe. With András, we will be speaking about the security situation of Hungary,
the contradictory defense policies of Viktor Orban,
the military balance in the Black Sea,
and unfortunately, hardly anything silly because we had so much to talk about with András.
Of course. So, hello, András.
Hello.
Hi, András.
Thanks so much for joining our podcast. When we introduced you, or to be more precise, when Theresa introduced you last time, she said you are the guy with the red pants. But to be a bit more professional, we should tell our listeners that you are a security expert from Hungary, that you are active in the liberal political party Momentum, which is fighting against Viktor Orban's almost dictatorship, and that you are also an expert on the Black Sea, one of the topics that we'd like to cover today. But why don't you explain a bit more about your own background, András, and tell us a bit how you became involved with Momentum and with the Black Sea?
Right. Well, hello, everyone, and thanks very much for having me on, Sebastian and Theresa. I run a small political risk intelligence firm called Millennium Emerging Europe in London. Basically, we assist people who invest into Eastern Europe with intelligence on political and regulatory risks and other types of risk in the region, security risks notably. When it comes to Momentum, I'm a senior foreign policy advisor there, responsible for foreign policy, European policy, security policy. I've always looked at it as a being a good citizen type of thing. The thing I'm doing for the greater good while doing fascinating things in my actual job. When I came back to Hungary from university some 4 years ago, I began to explore how if the sort of young intelligentsia in Budapest is up to anything. I had at that point been away from Hungary for about 5 years, and I had lost essentially most of my contact with those circles. But it didn't take long for me to find what would become Momentum. At that point, essentially an underground network of students and young professionals hellbent on toppling Orban, becoming a political party and toppling Orban. And I almost immediately took charge of the foreign policy team, which I have been leading ever since. Obviously, some 6 months after I joined in summer 2016, we went public with a campaign to stop the Budapest Olympics, and we have since grown to be the biggest opposition party in Hungary, which isn't saying much. We're on 10 to 14% and Fidesz is over 50, but we are working on it.
Very brave, I think. I talked to your party leader a few years back, and he described the way that you work in Hungary and what it is like to be an opposition party in the country of Viktor Orban. And it was so it differed so much from my experience in Austria's Liberal Party, NEOS, where everything is free and you can basically just contribute to the political sphere.
Right. Well, yes. And Hungary, you know, being active in opposition politics means taking on a lot of risks in your private life and your professional life. I, you know, by virtue of owning and managing a firm in England, I am somewhat shielded from those effects. But that cannot be said of most of my colleagues in the party.
You were talking about risks already before when you talked about your company. What do you actually mean by security risks? What are the security risks that your clients are afraid of in Central Europe?
Well, in Central and Eastern Europe, so this region that we sort of broadly call emerging Europe, these 20 countries stretching from the Balkans to the Baltics and from Austria to Ukraine. Well, it's essentially instability. It's an increase in the security threats faced by these countries. Clearly, you know, one need not look farther than Ukraine, where the foreign investors that had been present in large numbers before 2014 faced the sort of fat tail risk, as it were, that most foreign investors into Eastern Europe dread.
Mm-hmm. Anders, we, Sebastian and I, have met you as part of a group of liberal defense advisors a couple of years back that we also belong to. And one of the central topics that we keep spinning around in this group is the broad variety of threat perceptions that EU member states have. And we have come across that fact several times, that your threat perception differs fundamentally depending on geographic location, size of your country, whether the country is a NATO member or not, history with terrorism or whatever else. And we have found that these threat perceptions shape the way we look at the opportunity to have a fully integrated European defense force in the future and shape many other things. So what I wanted to ask you is what you perceive as the biggest threat for Hungary's security right now, and whether you think that differs from the threat perception of Hungary as a state, of Viktor Orban's view of what the biggest threat is right now.
That is very interesting. I think Hungary's security position is aligned with, even determined by, the security position of the alliances of which Hungary is a member. And that plural there, I think, you know, contains in itself the dilemma or the contradiction, if you will, because, of course, I mean, the European Union and NATO, and, you know, while perhaps some Western European Union member states would put the stress on the former, Eastern European Union member states tend to put the stress on the latter. And that is because the threat perception of these member states, and that includes Hungary, albeit to a lesser degree, certainly, than either Romania or Poland, let alone the Baltic states. The threat perceptions of these states are, you know, they perceive the Russian threat much more acutely than Western member states, and that is true of Hungary as well. And therefore, the stress when we say that our interests are aligned with those of the alliances of which we are members, the stress is on NATO, in which Hungary, certainly most Hungarians, alongside other Eastern European countries, see the primary guarantee of their security in the face of a potential Russian aggression.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that a bit surprising? I mean, Viktor Orban is very often seen a bit like very close to Putin and to other populists in Europe. So it doesn't seem logical that he or his government would be afraid of a Russian threat.
I thought you were asking about my on Hungary's threat perception rather than Viktor Orban's. Viktor Orban certainly sees it differently. Viktor Orban is pursuing a sort of a double game. He wants not to stray too far from our Western allies, but at the same time milk Russia, milk the Kremlin for all it's worth. And he's I'm not sure, frankly, whom he would name as the sort of primary sovereign threat to Hungary's security. As the primary threat, he would certainly name illegal migrants, which frankly I find ludicrous. But I'm not sure whom he would name as the primary sovereign threat. When it comes to military modernization, he's essentially going for upgrading territorial defense. He's going for modernizing a little bit across the board, and creating a sort of a large territorial defense force, which I think goes against common sense. I think what should be done is building on competitive advantages that we have, and perhaps developing new competitive advantages within NATO and the European Union, and moving towards a smaller, more mobile force. Because simply it's not, the threat that a land invasion isn't high on the list of realistic threats Hungary faces.
Mm-hmm. But Hungary isn't, as far as I know, active in the Sahel region or in the Middle East either, right? Because there are just some countries who would believe that by stabilizing those regions, they could reduce the number of migrants. Although this should maybe not be the first concern when conducting such interventions, but this would maybe be a logical move for Viktor Orban, but he doesn't do that, right?
He does it to some degree, Hungarian troops are actually present in a large number of NATO missions. Of course, we're talking small numbers of Hungarian troops, 3, 10, 15 in that it's that sort of order of magnitude. But we were there in Iraq, we were there in Afghanistan, we are there in Kosovo and Bosnia and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm. This sounds to me like this is like the minimum contribution and the minimum kind of investment you need to do to be considered a good ally, to be a member of the club, but with no real interest.
But that's certainly part of the logic behind it. And I think it's fully part of Viktor Orban's calculus. That he shouldn't stray too far from either the United States or Germany, most importantly, and that's a trend that can be observed not just in the NATO missions Hungary takes part in, but also in arms acquisitions, for instance. which are happening in large quantities from Germany, from the United States. But Hungary has also bought a factory in Austria, has bought a factory in Brazil. It is reportedly eyeing a factory in Germany. So yes, that is absolutely part of the game.
I have one more question, because I know that from previous conversations with you that you like to point out that Viktor Orban at some point has called for a European army in the past. And looking at the way he speaks about European integration today, it is hard to imagine that he once did take that position. So what do you think happened there? Was it ever something that he honestly wanted to pursue? Was it a mistake to say that back then? Has his opinion changed? What do you think?
I think it was never an honest ambition, but it's a sort of logical conclusion of his rhetoric on migration. So he has called for a European army many times, in fact, in the past years. I can't remember off the back of my head when the last time was, but yeah, maybe 2 years ago. It wasn't back in the Middle Ages. He talks about protecting Europe, right? Protecting Europe from migrants. He talks about protecting Europe's identity, and it follows logically from this rhetoric that he should support protecting the continent and protecting its identity with arms if necessary. If that were to mean giving up, the national armed forces, if that were to mean integrating the national armed forces into some sort of united European armed forces, that's certainly something that that Orban would perceive as a a grave attack on Hungary's national sovereignty. But a European army isn't happening. And Orban knows that. So it's something that he can easily call for unpunished, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Shall we? I think that was very interesting and long introduction to yeah. who you are and what is going on in your country defense-wise. I think that was a very good overview. Shall we move to our next topic, Sebastian?
Yeah, most definitely. We will get back to the European Army topic and on Andra's opinion in a few minutes. Thanks, first of all, for the nice country portray, which nicely adds to the puzzle which we're creating in this podcast. And we should now move on to the Black Sea, a topic that you are intensely working on, Andras, and which is rarely covered in the news in most European countries, but it's a topic that actually matters quite a lot right now at the moment. And maybe you can give us a little introduction. Why and how does it actually matter?
And wait, can I first explain why we even chose the topic of the Black Sea, other than your expertise in this area? A few months back, we the three of us and some other colleagues visited Ukraine, and we talked with a lot of experts, think tankers, people involved in politics in Ukraine, and we heard on many occasions that they said literally Russia controls the whole of the Black Sea by now. And looking into the positions that our liberal parties had on this issue, we quickly figured out that there was not much that we had on that, also because it is not part of the daily conversation in European security. So this is why we wanted to talk about this issue here in this podcast, because we think there is a huge gap of knowledge and also of liberal conversation on this topic.
Oh, yes.
Right. Right. So why it's important? Well, it's in an important geostrategic position, right? If you dominate the Black Sea, that gives you a degree of power over the Balkans, over Central and Eastern Europe, over the South Caucasus, over the Northern Middle East, and even to some extent the Eastern Mediterranean. Of course, there's extreme potential in the Black Sea. It could be an economic access point to Central Asia. It could help with European energy security. Think of the Romania's offshore reserves. Think of the Russian pipelines, Turk Stream, Blue Stream. Mm-hmm. It could be an access point for maritime trade, but for now, it's basically primarily a security risk. Russia has a clear interest in the region. Its frozen conflicts are concentrated in the sea's vicinity. The Georgian exclaves, the Crimea, Transnistria, they're all in the Black Sea region. Even the EU's global strategy identifies these conflicts in the Black Sea region as a challenge to European security, and this already interesting area became even more interesting with Russia's annexation of the Crimea in 2014, which completely changed the military balance in the Black Sea region. Ukraine lost significant access. It lost naval capability. It lost gas fields. And Russia basically became the dominant power with the greatest access. The number of its warships almost doubled. The number of its submarines grew from 1 to 7, and all of its assets are being modernized and armed with caliber missiles.
Mm-hmm. When we were in Kiev, we also learned that. Well, we all know that Crimea was illegally annexed by Russia. We've all seen in the news the incident when Ukrainian naval vessels were seized, when Ukrainian sailors were captured by Russia in the Kerch Strait. So we know that from Crimea to the east, Russia is able to control Ukraine's access to the Black Sea, and it's basically able to strip Ukraine off its access to the Black Sea. But what we've learned is that the same is actually possible to the west. There's not that much space. There's different drilling platforms that Russia already controls. So it could basically close this line of access as well, which would make Ukraine a landlocked country, basically, which would be disastrous for its access to sea trade lanes. Its naval capabilities and access to offshore resources. So this was really new to me, at least, I must say. With all the things that you've just explained, what would be your recommendation to other EU members and to the European Union? What should we do?
Well, first, just adding to what you just said, it's Russia now has Russia now essentially has anti-access and area denial capability over massive swathes of the Black Sea, not just you know, and that doesn't end in essentially blockading all of Ukraine, not just the Azov Sea, but all of Ukraine. That's only a part of it.
We should be, because not all our listeners are defense nerds, so we should very briefly explain to them what anti-access and area denial means.
Well, you're the naval man, Sebastian.
Well, it means that it has sensors and weapons to see what's actually going on, who's moving in the Black Sea, and it's able to attack targets, any other units which are operating in that area, and it has those assets in an amount which is sufficient enough to be defended against foreign airstrikes and so on. So it's not easy to change that situation. So this is maybe a brief way to explain it.
Yeah, exactly. And so basically, Russia's land-based and aerial anti-ship missiles and its electronic warfare capabilities are now matched with holding the best port in the Black Sea, Sevastopol, and Crimea, of course, the whole of Crimea, which is geostrategically important. So it makes Russia this combination an extremely strong challenger. And the fact is that the biggest NATO country in the region, Turkey, doesn't really help to tilt the balance in NATO's favor in the Black Sea. Turkey has a long history of trying to upkeep the Black Sea balance of power. It's not keen on seeing foreign ships entering, even NATO ships, through the Bosporus and Dardanelles straits. So practically, Russia and Turkey are the only significant players, and the balance is tilting heavily in Russia's favor. It's already tilted heavily in Russia's favor, and it's tilting further in Russia's favor. As for example, Russia is spending more on its naval capabilities, and Turkey's navy is purged by Erdogan. So it's not a particularly comforting sight.
Okay, but I mean, what I'm always wondering, I mean, everything you just described makes it clear that the situation in the region right now is a serious security risk. It matters to the European Union as well, but it is never really part of a conversation that you would notice around daily international and security politics talk within the European Union. I got even in 2018, when the Kerch Strait incident happened, there was the European Union issued a statement that called for de-escalation, and that was basically it. A few months later, somebody in my party asked, hey, whatever happened to these Navy vessels? Are the people free again? Nobody knew. So what I got from my conversations with people at NATO, at the OSCE and other security experts was that there is a sense that's basically let Turkey deal with that. If something serious would happen there, Turkey would have an interest to defend its influence in the Black Sea and would do something about it. But from everything that you just said regarding Turkey's behavior, is that a realistic expectation towards Turkey?
Maybe in the long term. Maybe in the long run. Well, look, Russia and Turkey are rivals in the Black Sea. There is a macro dynamic here. They will clash sooner or later. They have clashed several times in the past years. They will clash in the Black Sea as well. Perhaps there will be a shared threat perception will emerge between the sort of, Western and NATO players in the region. Maybe Romania and Bulgaria and Turkey, along with Georgia and Ukraine, will come to a common threat perception, to common understanding. You know, that I think is the long term solution. So that's an answer to Sebastian's question. But in the short run, what you can do is work with what you have, which is Romania and perhaps Georgia and Ukraine. With Romania, Romania already mentions in its national security strategy, it already mentions Russia as a threat. Of course, Romania's naval capabilities have been severely neglected, looted essentially over the past decades. But it has significant offshore oil wells, gas fields that need to be protected. Russia doesn't want to see an energy competitor in the region. Russia will do everything in its power. It has already been declaring exercises in the area in the vicinity of Romanian offshore energy fields to prevent navigation in the area, exercises that never took place. So Russia will do everything in its power to stop Romania from extracting the oil and gas that is there, and the West must do what it can to help them defend it and extract it, and to at the same time develop proper land-based defense.
Adding to that, I'm proud that I've already sailed the Black Sea back in 2004. I was a trainee on the German anti-air warfare frigate Saxony, and we sailed through the Bosporus and then to Sevastopol, which was great because Sevastopol was a very interesting touristy destination and the beer was very cheap. It was only later that I realized the real reason why we did that. The reason, of course, was that we basically demonstrated to others that we were able to go there, and we demonstrated to our partners like Ukraine and to our allies like Bulgaria and Romania that we would probably stand by their side if they needed our naval support. And there's a tool to do exactly that, which is called Freedom of Navigation Exercises. Andres, would you recommend the European Union navies or NATO navies to do more of that, to have more of a naval presence, not with the intention to basically go into any attack mode with Russian units, but just to demonstrate a bit more physical presence?
Absolutely, but it's difficult. It's difficult because the Montreux Convention, which is the piece of international law that regulates access to the Black Sea, limits the presence of foreign ships, that is ships from outside of the region, to 21 days, to spending 21 days within the Black Sea. And Turkey, as I said, is keen on enforcing that. It's keen on ensuring its primacy when it comes to NATO presence in the Black Sea, even as it's increasingly focused on the Mediterranean. The Mediterranean. So it's yes, I'd recommend it, but it's difficult. It's difficult also because under the original agreement between Ukraine and Russia on the Sea of Azov, Ukraine was allowed to invite U.S. warships to visit ports to visit Ukrainian ports in the Sea of Azov, for instance, as a sort of to form a tripwire force. But the situation is so delicate now that essentially no NATO country would like to get that close to what will be perceived as provoking Russia. Turkey would also not be enchanted by such steps. For Western defense, for Western support, for NATO states in the Black Sea region to be credible, to form a credible deterrent, it doesn't actually need to match Russia in military terms. If if it was only that advanced air and coastal defense systems were deployed to Romania and Bulgaria to counter Russian missile threats, if it was only a few NATO exercises, if it was only continued or perhaps stepped up assistance to Ukraine and Georgia in the development of national defense capabilities, that would be already a set of big steps forward. Also, big steps forward on the road to developing a common threat perception with among the NATO states in the region and between NATO states in the region and NATO states not in the region.
Okay, wow. So these were a lot of words, Andras, as usual. But I'm still very proud of you. I think given other conversations that I had with you in the past, this was actually pretty short and to the point. So we're now.
I've done my best. Thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. Also for these really interesting insights. I think we've done quite an interesting episode so far, and we're now coming to our final question. And you already know what it is because you've heard our previous episodes. Sebastian came up with the question. If European defense would be an animal, what would you want it to be? What should it be? And you have heard Ronaldo's and Ev's answers and talking about baby lions and hamsters. So I was really excited to hear your answer to this question. So what is your animal and why?
It'd be a unicorn. It'd be a unicorn. It would be a beautiful, beautiful creature that doesn't exist.
That is, you're a goddamn poet, man.
That's kind of a sad answer. It sounds a bit pessimistic.
Yeah, it couldn't have been more him, the answer. So I like this answer very much, and thank you for joining us today. I really had a great time today.
Thanks very much for having me on. It's been an honor. Thanks.
Thank you so much, and talk to you soon.
Cheers.
So this was our third episode of the Defense Cafe with Andras.
It is a bit, it is a bit unfortunate that we couldn't leave our listeners with a more positive feeling regarding a European defense union or European army in the future. What could we do about that in our next episode, Sebastian?
Well, yeah, you're right. Well, we could actually look for a true believer, someone who has some concrete ideas what could be done and who believes that those ideas could also be implemented one day. Someone who comes up with an animal that exists.
Yes, we can do that. And we might look a little bit more to the west geographically. We talked quite a lot with our colleagues from the east, with Renaldas and Andras now, so maybe a little bit more western would be good next time.
Sounds like a good plan. Yeah, let's keep it this way, and the rest, I guess, we will leave that open as a surprise. We will end this episode with a little cliffhanger for our listeners, and tune in next time for episode 4, and then you will learn who our next guest will be.
Thank you for listening, and if you like our podcast, please talk about it, share it on your social media, and give us your feedback.
Please do. Thank you and goodbye.
Goodbye.